to Sappy Fest Radio on CHMA 106.9 FM on a beautiful Friday morning in Sackville, New Brunswick. I'm your host and creative director, Stephen Lamke, and I'm very happy to welcome to the show today a very special guest, Nigel Chapman from Napeyes. Hello, Nigel.
Hello, Steve.
How are you today?
I'm well. How are you doing?
I'm well. We have you on the phone today. You're in Halifax?
That's correct, yeah.
And how are things there?
They're good, yeah. I'm sitting here in my living room looking out the window, and yeah, this morning started out like pretty gray. Yesterday was really gray and cold, but today it seems like it's getting sunny, and yeah. Doing pretty well otherwise. Yes. Yeah,
we had a terrible day here in Sackville yesterday. I have to say, we'll put it on the historical document that is this radio show.
It was
dreary, and my sympathies go out to all of us here in town who suffered through it. It's turned into a glorious summer day. Spring. We'll say spring. I'll still say spring. Day.
Well, yeah, that's legit. Yeah, I know, right? It's like, I mean, technically, we still have a few days till summer, so
yeah,
doing all right.
We are speaking on June 15th, is that correct? June 15th.
Oh, yeah, that's today. That's right, exactly. So we have until, I don't know what it is, the 20th or 21st, yeah. When it technically becomes the next season.
The solstice. Nigel, I have something that I've been thinking about that I wanted to maybe get your thoughts on.
Sure.
If you'll bear with me for a moment. This is Sappy Fest Radio. This summer is Sappy Fest 13, our 13th annual festival. And I've been thinking a lot about what it means to do this year after year. To gather together like this, to put a festival together, for us to congregate in a similar way every year, the first weekend of August. And I know that you have recently been on tour a lot with Napeyes in support of your recently released I'm Bad Now album. And I know from my own personal experience that being on tour involves a lot of routine and repetition of loading in to the venues, sound checks, performing many of the same songs night after night, you know, looking for places to eat, selling merch, long drives. And I've been trying to think through how ritualistic behavior and repetitions are a way in which, as humans, we create meaning, but that also are often a route to madness.
True. Yeah, both sides seem, both of those seem real. I relate to what you just talked about for sure. I think I'm someone that, I mean, I think that there's a range of, like, with among humans, there's a range of novelty seeking personality types. Everyone seeks it sometimes, it's sort of been found genetically. Like, there's certain variants of the dopamine receptor that get us more the people that are born with this variant are more likely to be novelty seekers. Like, you know, this person is like that much more predisposed towards being someone who tries bungee jumping or wants to go like world traveling or something, you know. And there's others who basically have the more normal variant or the more typical variant, and that's usually a bit more reserved. I mean, I'm really simplifying and partly talking out of my ass here, but I've been thinking about that sort of thing lately with respect to ritual and routine and versus novelty. So it's kind of a meandering response idea, but I think I'm someone, as far as I know, who really, you know, at least externally, I benefit a lot from routine and regularity. Especially like my own home life, you know, where I'm not like driving to a different city each day or something. I really like it at home, you know, I really like it here. And because I just feel like, I don't know, it's a different kind of like control and ability to access solitude, you know, for longer periods of time and stuff. But but then I have my solitary rituals, which I think are of great benefit to me. But also, like, you know, getting dragged kicking and screaming to the group ritual is also, I think, highly beneficial for me. So I guess I'm really happy and grateful that in this line of work, I kind of get to do both of those things, like sort of disappear into a quite a far solitary tunnel, you know, where I feel like quite secure that I'll have some time to sort out some things in there, and if anyone comes to the door, like I'll be able to you know, make that 20-minute trip back or whatever. But there's something I like about that sort of introspective, reflective time. But then also, like, if I only had that and didn't have the kind of work that that where we do these regular rituals of like driving to the city, sound checking, you know, visiting with the venue staff, like getting a meal somewhere, maybe seeing friends that live in each place. That also is a really beneficial thing. This is all like Nigel related, and I think you were speaking more generally about ritual. And then I think that especially Sappy Fest, like as a particular case, you know, it can't really be, I can't put it into like a general like concert festival template or whatever, because it is such a special festival in terms of like the way that the festival goers feel, I think, like connected to one another and as all part of the same thing. I suppose it's probably more common with smaller festivals than larger festivals, but it has a lot to do with the geography and the people in Sackville and the people are, you know, that are coming there and kind of what we get out of it. But it seems like it's something that benefits everybody like a lot to take part in that thing. And yeah, when I first went in 2012, I was like, whoa, this sort of thing exists. I hadn't known about it. And I was like, but I had friends who had like talked about how great it is. And I was like, oh, this is what they mean. So it was cool to see what it's like. But yeah, I think Sappy Fest is amazing.
I do as well, obviously. And I've chosen to dedicate a certain amount of my time and thought and, you know, efforts and human energy to it. So you referred a little bit there to sort of that tension between solitude and the group.
Oh, hello.
Are you getting arrested right now, Nigel?
Hello?
Hello. Are you there? Can you hear me, Nigel?
Oh, yeah, now I hear you again.
Okay,
yeah.
Perfect.
I think it cut out when you said you referred to, and then
I was worried for a moment that you were getting arrested there.
Oh yeah, you could hear the yeah. So where we live, we get a lot of ambulance and police traffic. Yeah, good reminder that things are happening out there.
I was going to ask you about that tension between solitude and sociability or the interaction with the public sphere, because I feel like that's a reoccurring theme in a lot of your songs.
Yeah, for sure. It's something like I could give like a like the like a 10-minute meandering.
We have a lot of time. The point of these conversations is to meander as much or as little as we choose. So there's no authority but ourselves here, Nigel.
Oh, Okay. Oh, cool. Okay. Thanks. That's good to know. So then I'll try to be bound by like coherence kind of principles. But I won't worry about external about rules. Timing, so this is a good place to be. So I think in my case, it's taken me a long time to come to terms with who I am and my personality type. I think I've always had that tension, like basically the desire to go into my own world, and like how I think like as a child and as a young person, like I just didn't even think twice about it. It was a very nice state of existence where like I just had no second thoughts about like following my sort of inner compass, if you know what I mean. And I'm not talking about like values, like or you know, like conscience and this sort of thing, but more like the direction of your psyche, like your psychic intent or something at any given time. And so if it feels like, you know, going out, you know, it goes out, and you just let it. And if it feels like orienting inwards and exploring around in there for a while, you let it. If it feels like engaging with some like object, like a book or a game or something, or music, you just let it. And then you don't feel a sort of pressure that you have to sort of be doing a certain kind of activity at any given time. And that's just a child's mindset, I guess, as much as anything, which I really liked. I was enjoying it. And then, you know, as you grow older, I think you become aware of certain things, which is really good. You become aware of, like, the existential example for me in my vocation is, like, I used to sing, like when I was learning to sing, I was singing so loud all the time, as loud as I could sing it, you know, at my young age, because all the music I listened to, the singers were singing at full volume most of the time, like especially in punk rock music or whatever. And I just, you know, I was like playing, like banging away on my acoustic guitar with very little control of dynamics, you know, and this sort of thing, or in my rock band back then, and just things that sound probably, like, objectively speaking, pretty bad. Like anyone that's got an ear for music and tonality would probably have been like, oh, this is like difficult to hear. I might be being a bit hard on myself now, but not that hard given how it started out. And so I think that at that time, like, I was just blissfully unaware that like anyone would even be bothered by it. And this was like an interesting thing that I really liked about my family. They just like, everyone kind of has that introverted tendency. So we all just kind of go into our own worlds or different parts of the house or whatever. And no one ever was like, Nigel, you're too loud. Like, I think once when I was like 20, like after I was like back, like living at my parents for a little bit, like I was playing, you know, guitar fairly late at night, and my dad was like, it's just a bit too loud, you can't, you know, noisy. But before that, it never, you know what I mean, it just never, I never had a second thought about it. This is turning into a meandering answer, but my idea there was just like, it was great, you know, to not worry. And then I had around the age of 20 to now, like a gradual awakening and coming to terms with the fact that everything I do has an impact, like, on the ones around me, you know, more or less. And sometimes it's like you just want to frolic and revel and like naturally follow your heart desire. And you know, sometimes it brings you down when you realize that like others aren't like as into that idea, or like they don't see the meaning in what you're doing or something. So then you start to question the meaning in what you're doing, like this kind of thinking, which is sort of like related to a social self-awareness, but also self-consciousness. It's a real drag. And like, as a young person, like a kid, I never had that. And then, you know, it kind of rose for a while. And that's like that conflict of adulthood and realizing your place in the world and stuff. Like, I feel like that that has been sort of like a tension for me, but also like a necessary part of my training or whatever, you know, to become a decent person, but still not throw, you know what I mean? Like not throwing away your individual values, the things that you cared about as a young, like when society's like, oh no, be quiet. Be quiet. You're a little bit, you know what I mean? Like how much should you listen to? Like you should listen a little, but not that much, you know? And that's the difficult thing. Sometimes it feels bad to do what is the most true thing or whatever. So that's my kind of tension there. And yeah, it remains, but I think I'm getting better at navigating with it.
I feel like you're describing, when you're describing encountering those boundaries, social boundaries, you're questioning whether you're experiencing them as limitations on your personal freedom or on your own personality, or if you're experiencing them as knowledge being gleaned from the world around you.
Right. Totally. The that's both, like, it has both the positivist and negativist aspect or whatever. Definitely. And so sometimes I feel like usually I have to get my mind rolling in the direction of the positive appreciative one when it comes to things like that, which initially, you know, are just a bit like jarring or frustrating or whatever. Like the first thing you feel is your urge being, you know, like pushed against or denied. And the second thing you kind of like have a cognitive thought about is like, why is this happening? Oh, it's probably because I'm having some kind of effect that is a nuisance on others or whatever. Okay, I'm actually grateful for this feedback because it's good for making me a good person. You know, like that is it's like a secondary thought process, which is like very natural and necessary. But yeah, usually like to get my mind rolling in that direction, I have to like take a deep breath, if you know what I mean, so that I don't just like knee-jerk react to like the frustration of being blocked. And again, sometimes it feels like others are knee-jerk reacting to me, so like without really knowing, you know, what's going on for me or whatever. And I don't mean that in a sense of like, oh, I encounter this like persecution every day, but it you know, it's something that's real, that none of us really appreciates what's going on in the other person's world sufficiently to, you know, like, but I think people are better at that than me for sure. Yeah, so I don't know if that where that goes in particular, but I just meant to say that like both the frustration and like sense of like even indignation, you know, it's like an unpopular kind of mind, like mood to be in these days, but certainly it's not useless. It probably helps you, you know. And people, you know, it's just like orienting it in the right way. There are certain circumstances where people seem to say indignation is okay, and others when it's like more of a faux pas. But I think it's just as a mental trait, it can be useful, or it can be, you know, block you from achieving what you want to do. So just have to let it manifest. And try to let it do its thing when it's appropriate, and to try to rein it in when it's like not helpful, you know, to you or others. So yeah, I think that's another idea.
I think I noticed in a lot of your songs, and in this conversation a little bit too, you ask yourself a lot of questions that sort of seem to revolve around the question of what is good. Yeah, like morally good or right behavior or sort of correct thought.
Yes.
And I know that you have a background in science, and that I sort of recognize in that thinking like a search for sort of an objective measurement or an objective truth. And my question, I guess, is how much do you believe that there is, that you might actually find an objective measurement or truth for some of these questions and in some of these realms of morality or behavior.
Totally right, right. That seems like, almost on the face of that question, like the appropriate thing for me to do is to acknowledge that I have no idea. like, but I have my hunches and I have my like things that I'll act on, which will suggest that I know the answer. That, you know what I mean? I will presuppose that I know the answer to that question in most situations. But if I look at the question in its stark nakedness or whatever, I should acknowledge that I have no idea. But that being said, you know, I do think that when it comes to ideas of correctness or moral rightness or righteousness, even like ideas of like harmony and discordance, like usually are helpful concepts. And just like in music, discordance does not mean it's the wrong thing at a given time, you know? So like in a song, discordance can be very appropriate. So disharmony between individuals can make sense sometimes. And you know, like nobody knows maybe like which moral rightness side to fall into, but sometimes speaking in terms of harmony and disharmony, you have to be like in a you know what I mean? Like you don't want to placate the world. So morality is obviously not about that. But at the same time, like there are things that you know, it's not that you just want to make everybody feel good, like you do, but it's that you want what's best. Like I think morality is tied to what is actually best for people, right? So like, and they have a good idea of what that is, and you might have your own ideas about what that is for society, and probably you know best what that is for yourself, and so, or like best, but you know, still insufficiently. But those kinds of measures, that none of them are exact, like in an absolute sense, you know. So your question is referring to like moral objectivity versus subjectivity. Certainly we know there's moral subjectivity, like feelings of being like pleased by a certain kind of action, appalled by another. We subjectively feel this very strongly. I think there's a good case to be made that some universal principles, if applied with like correct understanding, would constitute some kind of morally objective reality or whatever, like something like the only thing we know as bad basically is something that causes suffering to living beings. So therefore, if there is such an action that like can minimize suffering for living beings, you know, like on the whole, then this should be a morally good action. And if there's something that's bringing it down, it's a morally bad action. But then you can immediately see how like, okay, well, like if we're taking, like, when we're considering the greater part of living beings, like who are all the living beings, you know, like if this one action means like 100 people are going to get hurt, but this other person is going to not get hurt at all, or this one action means this one person's going to die, but like 10,000 people win the lottery, you know what I mean? This kind of thing, it's like these should like rightly inspire in us a sense of like confusion. And like, how do you answer that kind of question? So that I think when it comes down to it, like I do believe there's probably some kind of morally objective reality, and oftentimes when people can't see sufficient number of links in the chain, they might think like, oh, it's very good for my people, like, you know, my like German people or whatever, like to have, you know, more Lebensraum, you know, because I'm seeing the suffering of my German people, and like there's not enough, you know, whatever it is, like, or we're getting, you know, boxed in by the other countries, and you know, it's very important for me. So you're looking at like this massive group that you're trying to make happy, but obviously, you know, from within that, you can see that the person might be doing something which might even be good for most of the people in that country, but it obviously would have horrific or negative consequences for people outside the boundary. How do you choose a boundary? Like, how do you choose whether something is, you know, like going to hurt you in the short term, but to be to your benefit in the long term, like an important surgery or something, or like when you start exercising or something, you know, like, so it's really, like, anyway, this is a rambling and meandering answer with very little coherent points and obviously just my own ideas. So, but I am concerned with these questions, I think, of like, what's the right and wrong thing for me to do, basically, you know, and like, because that helps me to see the world, like, through a clear enough framework that my actions seem to have meaning, you know. So that I think is when it comes down to it, the use of morality for me is through my subjective morality,
with the goal being the creation of meaning.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, I really do believe in that, like the Viktor Frankl, like Man's Search for Meaning kind of stuff. Like his school of therapy, he considered it logotherapy, or like the therapy of meaning. And so, like, the way to make people have like fulfillment and satisfaction and happiness is for them to like basically create meaning for themselves and live lives that are sort of in a self-contained way meaningful to them, you know. So I think that's really important, but I don't know that I acted out very effectively.
Well, we've been talking about this all fairly abstractly, so I'm curious about how I'm curious about the practicalities of your artistic practice and how you go about creating and writing, and but also how that practice ties into this these conversations we're having about, you know, the creation of meaning and you know, and ritual and so forth as well.
Yeah. Well, that's thanks for being interested in that kind of thing in my creative practice. I guess that, yeah, I think these ideas definitely, they interact with the practice in one way or another, and sometimes they seem like how can I say, like, depending on the angle you look at it, these kinds of ideas about existence, like, let's call them existential ideas, they can be in one sense like fodder for the creative process, you know, like you have some then conceptual ideas and like you know, associated imaginative flights of fancy or you know, questions like about meaning and what do you do and what is life about, you know. So you're using the song, you're using that as material to create your song. And at the same time, the song itself, like the practice, could be seen as a way to like to actualize those ideas. Like, I know it might sound like it's still like just a game, like to some people, like the way I think they think about, and again, like I have to, you know, be conscious like of my tendency to project basically judgmental or like mocking practical demons out there, you know, like the idea that like that person's wasting their life, or that person's like selfishly pursuing like creativity or whatever, like just to like satisfy themselves, and like they don't care about, you know, like they don't know what it's like to work or something, you know, that kind of idea. Anyway, I might be projecting that it exists, but I think I've encountered it before. But really, when I talk about actualizing these things through writing or through songs, like I think it's not just a game, you know. Like there's a real effect to the to you in making or performing like a song that has some questions that you don't necessarily answer, but you point your mind to that question for the duration of the song, which is like 3 minutes. If you can keep your mind focused on the song for that length of time, then your mind will literally occupy that question, existential question, for that period of time. And this can actually have like real effects, you know, like in your life. and maybe even on the lives of like listeners. But also like, you know, it's certainly not magical. Like, you know, like there's a sense in which like it does feel like just a, you know, a game or something. But that's the kind of game that I like the most, you know, so I would like to keep playing it, you know.
That's a wonderful and very curious answer to my question. excuse me. And how do you go about writing a song, Nigel? Because you're describing a fairly meditative state in when you just were responding there. I think.
Yeah, something like it.
State of contemplation.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. Like, ideally, you know, like if you're not just going through the motions, which, like, literally, like, I want to make clear that at least half of the time I'm playing a song, like, my mind is elsewhere, you know? Like, so, like, I want to, like, for the audience's sake, like, for everybody's sake, I want to do a performance where the whole time I'm really in it. And I think, you know, some of our best performances or recordings would, you could say that about them. But there's in many cases, just because of the nature of day-to-day life, yeah, you can't, I can't achieve that, you know, every time I play a song. Maybe if I keep practicing.
Okay.
Yeah.
What about the group aspect of that? And that's something maybe we have neglected so far in this conversation, that we're speaking to you as the songwriter or the lyricist and you know, singer of Napis, but Napis is a group of people, and for the most part, when you're playing these songs, you're playing them with your bandmates.
That's right. Yeah.
So what are your thoughts on how this conversation is maybe altered or enhanced by the fact that this is in many ways actually like for primarily a group activity?
Totally. Yeah, totally. Yeah, it makes a big difference. It changes it significantly. I think in terms of like right off the bat, like, I mean, it's just what it's doing is a kind of an evidence in the phenomenon. Like if you listen in the records, you actually hear what's happening. What you're hearing is like, is the outcome of that, you know, like, because it doesn't really, I mean, when it comes down to it, the phenomenon like is what you all are hearing. Like for me, like, and for the others in the band, like what we're doing, what our minds are thinking about when we do it, and what we think about it when we're not at work, you know, like when we're off of that, all of those things are part of it in our minds, but in you know, in the audience's experience, none of that stuff matters. And so I think that, I guess I wanted to say that off the bat. But the fact that it is this collaborative process makes that more clear to me, you know, like that reveals more clearly the social dimension, like by having others who are performing with me, that brings home even more clearly like the meaning of an audience. Like what does that mean, like who are, you know, like understanding, it doesn't matter the understanding, but yeah, so I feel pretty like moved by that aspect of things. So it changes what it's like for me, I guess is what I was trying to say, to play with the others. And then, yeah, I think we all bring our own, like, philosophy and aesthetic, like, sensibilities to the equation. So, yeah, I wonder what else to say. But, yeah, it makes a big difference.
I think that, well, I can say for myself that I am happy And that I think for all of us, we have to be happy with the inconclusiveness of the answers we're finding to some of these questions.
good.
Both today and obviously much more in general. In the catalog of NAPI's work, there's a fair number of references to various and different and distinct spiritual practices.
I'd say that's true.
Okay.
Seemingly.
I'm curious about your relationship to the spiritual and spiritual practices. And I'm also curious if these different references that I'm referring to are a indication of perhaps a seeking or almost an experimental process that you are conducting with the spiritual, where you're testing things.
I like to imagine myself in that way. but I don't, you know, again, I'm always fraught with questions of like whether I could or really do live up to, you know, that sort of self-image. But I think I do, especially if I focus on like the tentativeness of it, like a scientist, like, you know, so I was, as soon as I started thinking about like religion and spirituality, like when you start to ask that question, like my mind, you know, gets excited by that, that dimension of life, you know, because it's like this. So it's like, and I don't mean to say it's like this, let me reduce it. Like, I mean, I do mean to say that, but like, let's acknowledge it's impossible that I could say it's like this, but for the sake of our discussion, it's the idea being that like, if God is real, like then God is certainly the most important thing. Now I don't personally believe in God gnostically, you know, like, and I think my general position is like one of like, in case that people are like on a metaphysical level of like, of evaluating truth claims, like, or something like this. Like, if someone was claiming on that basis that, you know, I definitely know that God is real, then I would say, like, probably that person has some, like, logical links missing in their thing, which would be an evidence if we got into it. But for the people that are just feeling it fundamentally, like almost as a route through which their whole existence framework manifests or appears, you know, it doesn't matter. Like, that doesn't matter. So I think, and you know, both types of people. And the third type, I guess, the non-theistic, like the whatever, not like something which is it is also exclusive from these options that are on the table, but I think also every person has access to this same essential like life essence. That's would be the idea, I think. So I think, right, you know, like that's as far as I have come to like think about the issue. That's where it would seem to land. But that's sort of beside the point, or the understanding is kind of beside the point, because the thing that is there that is exciting is like the thing is there, you know, that's would be what you want to focus on. And I think I do prefer anything that's minimally dogmatic, and any direction that religion takes, which is more figurative, symbolic, like meta symbolic This is the direction that I am sympathetic to, and I am less sympathetic to any kinds of reactionary orthodox current, but I understand where it's coming from and why it has to be that way. So, but just, you know, hopefully over time that those currents of progress and like life evolution and spiritual evolution will also manifest in the various traditions around the world. But it doesn't matter. I think, you know, when it comes to spiritual practice, I think even people who are dogmatically pro God have a point. You know, that we really, there's something important there to look into, and it might not look the same to me. Like, once I listen to their advice and try to look, it might not look like what they're telling me it looks like, but it is the most important thing, you know. So that's why, like, I think that's why, you know, that impulse is like it's a benefit, positive, easy to get confused about. Present speaker not excluded.
To ground this part of the conversation into something a little more specific, I have for a long time wanted to ask you about the song "White Disciple," which is the final song on "I'm Bad Now," but it's actually one of it's an older Napi song. Am I right in that?
Yeah, that song is from something like 2012, I think.
And it's an incredibly beautiful, powerful song, and the version on "I'm Bad Now" is extraordinary, and it's amazing, and I'm very moved by it every time I listen to it, and I'm moved by the narrative. But I have to admit, Nigel, I'm completely befuddled about what's happening in that song.
I understand, like, because I think that for me, that's something that, like, that others that are close to me have also said exactly what you just said. So, I mean, not exactly with all the kindness. I wanted to especially appreciate that. So thanks for saying that. That's really nice. And that helps me a lot. But then I also wanted to say that it's not unusual to not understand exactly what I would have meant. You know, from coming from the outside, this would strike me as a difficult proposition. And so, yeah, but in the case of this song, I could still try to explain it in some kind of framework. And then you could kind of like what I would try to do in explaining this would be like, imagine you or me, and then like use what I'll tell you now to like imagine yourself into that speaker or narrative or persona, you know. And I think that's like what a lot of the time we do with music anyway, or, you know, when you watch a movie, you like identify with the characters, like, sure. Oh, don't do that to so-and-so, like, you know, that's such and that's such. And you really are connected. But I also enjoy speaking in a way which is, like not deliberately esoteric to make it sound like I'm trying to frustrate anyone, but more in a way like there's a sort of a sparseness to some of my favorite, and I don't think that I achieve this, but in terms of filling in detail, like my favorite writing sometimes leaves a lot of things unsaid or whatever, so you can tell as you're listening that it, like, there's something here, but it's indicating it, which is behind the actual content of the song. And if I tried to cram all those things into the song, it would be a terrible song. And I've done that, where I think, you know, it's more, I just make every little step like more, you know, clear, but, and that's okay. Actually, I don't mean to say that a straightforwardness is not good. In fact, it's just a balance, I guess is what I mean. But that's a kind of a preambling, preface, disclaimer thing. But the actual song content, in that case, thank you for being interested, patient. Yeah, in terms of what I mean and why disciple, it's something like this young person. Okay, first thing I wanted to say is like the why disciple is like not the protagonist, although the voices keep changing, you know, and we don't know who is this why disciple or really who is the speaker, but the why disciple is not the speaker, you know. The why disciple is a personage. It's hard to say, but I think that, like, I know that personage, the white disciple, through my own psyche more deeply than I know it in any external personage in my life. But I have met external personages, brief interactions with them, whom, like, I kind of surmised from knowing these people that such a character exists in my psyche or in anyone's psyche, the white disciple. And so this white disciple, it is really he is an archetype, you can say, that exists within the consciousness of the singer, of the person in the song, the voice in the song. But the white disciple archetype is, I don't know if he's even a pure archetype. He's twisted, is what I'm trying to say about him, you know. So I don't know if you can have a twisted person be an archetype, or if that's a twisted archetype, if the archetype is pure, but then a twist happened before it got to my consciousness. Out of the unconscious, you know what I mean? That kind of idea. Maybe the white disciple is actually, like, that's not an archetype per se, but it's like a deeper, more fundamental archetype, like expressing through some of my own, like, conscious, personal, unconscious, like, twistedness, if you know what I mean? There could be, like, he could just be, like, the sage figure, let's say, but he's getting twisted. He's getting twisted, like, on his way to interacting with me, Nigel. And this is the thing about the white disciple. And I've also seen the white disciple, like I said, I didn't see him, I didn't meet him, but I know him in the world, in the sense that, like, there are such people that, whether or not they are doing it like sincerely or like with a manipulative, like, cynicism, but there are such people who really are trying to, if a young man is passing in the street looking a little bit lost, these people will try to encourage them into their fold, so to speak. I think often with really good intentions. And actually in Canada, it's a cultural, like, I don't want to speak in a way that sounds too, like, what you can say, vague, because in Canada, like some of the inspiration for this, now I don't want to put all the baggage of my twisted white disciple archetype onto these people that may not deserve it, if you know what I mean, but I saw the potential in those people and the structure of authority and the structure of, like, exoticism, like that they're interested, you know, like young white men, you know. And but I want to say that just as an aside, like, that of course should have no stigma in and of itself, like neither should masculinity, you know, have a stigma in and of itself, but of sure. course the toxicity, the twistedness, you know, these things are stigmata, or these things are bad, you know, like to simplify. But don't let's not get stuck, because if the conversation got stuck, you know, on like only a white man would be anything like this, then people would fail to see the universality of the archetype, you know. They would get stuck in a mundane detail that's like boring to even, I'm not saying there's not an appropriate time and place, but anyway, that's my own songwriting area that I feel this is, you know, I can clear this domain away for the moment, just speaking in terms of the terms, so that it has like a clarity and it gets across some of the aesthetic meaning that I'm trying to do. I don't like to be derailed by my own psyche, you know. But then I guess so. When I'm thinking of this white disciple character, I really believe in him, like in the sense that like I really know like what kinds of things he would tell me, and I don't mean to make this sound like hocus pocus or something like that. Mm-hmm. What I mean is like I have different kinds of desires speaking to me, you know, in my own world, in my own like consciousness, that come at me, that try to tell me different kinds of things. And it really like it's a quite a wide range, you know, what they seem to want me to do. And I mean right now I'm dramatizing this a little bit because my life feels pretty mundane, and I want to emphasize that I don't feel too persecuted by many, many different voices speaking in my mind, which is, let me mention, is a real delusion that people, especially with schizophrenia, do suffer from, or experience, I should say, because it's probably suffering, but also they could gain some kind of insight out of this. So they have a specialness to their consciousness. It's very, very different, you know, that this and I have no idea what it's like, you know what I mean? So I just wanted to emphasize that, you know, it's like because of how cool certain things about autism are, you know, sometimes people want to like identify themselves on the spectrum or whatever, or like, you know, there's various spectra, and I think that's, you know, schizophrenia probably has a normative, you know, like there's a whole spectrum of basically how well does this person fit into society, how well do these schizophrenic people fit into society, and the people that are more able to conform, and I don't mean conform like in a kind of a, this is such a tangent, by the way, so sorry. I can't stop at any time. But these people, if they're more able to conform, then it doesn't really matter how different or how out there their psyche is, because they also can see what it's doing, and they can see what the others are responding to. So there's some kind of sense of like, okay, we know as sort of like it's related actually to the prescriptions and the feeling of maybe feeling limited a bit by the social public sphere or whatever, but also learning from it. Like if they can do that learning, they can allow those limitations, you know, to be placed on them. Yeah. Then they will be able to live like a normal lifestyle, in the sense like not seen as someone with a pathological neuropsychiatric disorder. So there is a full spectrum, and I do think that this is how like someone who's on the schizophrenia spectrum comes to be cured. It's like this is when they are cured. It's when they reach that point of like understanding how, you know, to interact with and to live in harmony with, or in peaceful coexistence with others, you know. But I mean, this is speaking as someone who has no idea what he's talking about, because like I have never, like all I know is like the neuroscience, you know, the behind schizophrenia when it manifests, but I don't understand, you know, like what it's like for that person, you know. So what I also don't understand is how severe it gets, because like there's mental health professionals that are working in this field that are seeing like how extreme can the schizophrenic mind, you know, manifest, like how sort of debilitating and tragic it can be. So anyway, so this is a big aside, just related to the idea of having multiple voices inside your own mind. I don't think it's something you should be worried about per se at all. In fact, like Carl Jung was saying, is like you should, if you see that voice or hear that voice, its distinctive character, different from the other voices in your mind, then pay attention to it, or like try to understand, get a clearer image of what that person looks like. And so twisted or not, anyway, the white disciple comes to me. But he, like, on a society basis, like, what he is like, he's, you know, I don't know what he's power tripping or something, but he thinks somehow that the best thing for him to do is to convince these young people to basically hem themselves in, you know, to like, basically, you know, like, this idea that just twist them in, like, he doesn't see it as twisted, right? Maybe he doesn't. Maybe he just, everything's twisted to him, so it's natural for things to twist up. But the point about this is related to religious repression. And I think that we really need to be kind of conscious of how it works and why it makes sense to our minds to say, like, when there's something that I'm devoted to, this is the way that it should kind of twist, like, you know, like, because I'm unworthy or something, you know, like, unworthiness paired with the divinity, like, in concepts, if you take these together, then it's like, one, it's so extreme and unreachably beautiful, and it just emphasizes how hideous our human failings are, which makes us want to twist them up, you know. And this is a pathological perversion of a very beautiful idea, you know, like a very beautiful postulation, if you will, about the nature of the universe. You think that you know the answer, so you tell someone or you tell yourself that, like, okay, and that means also that your hideous, unworthy humanness must be, like, cut off or twisted up, you know, like, because you thought that you knew the answer, you know. But if you didn't think, if you, anyway, I thank you for indulging me at great length to speak, like, in this way, because that's what I feel like naturally, like, doing, you know. It would get boring eventually, but this has felt like an interesting idea that, and I'm so happy that you wanted to know and that I got to speak about that a little bit. So the white disciple, basically what I was trying to express in that song, white disciple, dangerous archetype, twisted archetype, projecting onto the youth. Will the youth be overcome by this archetype? And in the case of the song, not the case. The youth makes it out. And like, you can see that white disciple is an archetype. You can see him as, like, literally the person in the community that's like, no, this is what God is, and like, I need you to do this, I definitely need you to not ever have sex or smoke weed or something, you know, and these are what I need you to do, and, like, by the way, here's some other fucked up information or some other beautiful idea, symbology. The complex, you know, but, well, this person, I don't want to write them off, and I don't want to say that what they're putting out into the world is exclusively negative, but, you know, it's a little bit of snake oil mixed in. It's a little bit, like, we just shouldn't, you know, it's like, it's just like having a laugh. It's all right, you know, what's going on there, as long as, you know, the individuals retain their freedom. You know, it's totally fine, actually, for someone to be kind of suggesting some ideas to you, trying to convince you of them or whatever, as long as there's nothing, like, that approaches any kind of, like, psychological or physical, like tension structure, like tying someone up, you know? Like, that kind of thing obviously is twisted. And I think, you know, there's a difference between that and between your ordinary, like proselytizing person doesn't have that kind of intention. So this is really like a dramatization of, like, what is generally, like, at least where I am, you know, I haven't seen too many, like, lives go, like, you know, get sucked into some kind of vampirical. I see that the possibility, and I can see the way that youths would do it to themselves, you know. That's my biggest concern is, like, you have some teacher that just, the main thing is they don't even know They're not the white disciple, this teacher. The white disciple is latent in the mind of the spiritual student, you know what I mean? And the spiritual student is ambitious and has their own, like, really, like, desperate need to connect or something. And this person up here, like, this is Nigel's, like, distrust of it. Like, no one has the answer for you, you know? No authority figure, you know? So the best thing you can hope for is for someone to teach you to do something. But you shouldn't expect for them to, like, answer your question. So, and I mean, answer your existential questions for you. I just mean, they should teach you, you know? That's the natural transmission. That's something that, you know, is like, you know, it still exists in parts of society, and it still exists in different cultures, like, more clearly. But, like, learning an artisan skill or something, or, like, learning from the teacher, like, I don't know why it had so much baggage for me, you know. I just had so much independence or something that, like, you know, I just didn't, I don't know. So this is where it comes down to my unique psychology and my own hang-ups. You can see kind of how that relates into, like, the whole picture as well. But, yeah. Anyway, Steve, I don't know if this was helpful, but the main thing was that's kind of a white disciple picture there.
Nigel, thank you so much for your generosity with your thoughts today, and your generous answers to my questions. I appreciate that very much.
Oh, that's so kind. Steve, it's so nice talking to you. I really appreciate it that you asked me those things, and I was happy to answer them.
Yeah, so thank you so much. This is Sappy Fest Radio, CHMA 106.9 FM in Sackville, New Brunswick, with my very special guest today, Nigel Chapman from NAPI's. And Nigel, I think we are out of time.
I understand.
For today. So once again, thank you for joining us. I think we should probably go out by perhaps listening to White Disciple as we say our goodbyes.
Sure, it's fine by me.
Yeah, and thanks everybody for listening. And Nigel and NAPI's will of course be at Sappy Fest 13 this summer, August 3rd to 5th here in Sackville.
Thanks everybody up there.
All right, thanks, Nigel. I hope you have a wonderful Friday, the rest of your day today, and we'll talk soon, I hope.
You too, Steve. Yeah, that sounds great.
All right. Bye, Nigel.
Bye.
When he sent for me, it doesn't matter what anyone was born to be. But your life is pointless unless it sets you free. So won't you set me free? Set me free. It was at the fountain where water gathered, we had found Roman signs on the paths behind. But to my spiritual brother, I remain spiritually blind until my Venetian blinds was left behind. Relaying me in my soul full of sin, my doesn't matter what anyone was born to be. But your life is pointless unless it sets you free. So won't you set me free? Set me free. to call out to them, saying to my older brother, I recognize him, yes. Younger brother, won't you please come in, sit down for a while, cross your legs for a it sets you free. So won't you set me free? Set me free. Now the boy was bright like a burning cinder. He was young like all the good martyrs have been. The crimes of his childhood burn in him like a fever. The dreams of his youth ready to be fenced in. Yes, but the little boy was faster. When he woke one morning in the Dharma house, in Krishna's temple, the cathedral's crypt. In a sloppy right-handed new Roman script and shit. Set me free, so